hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-14873, Mauna Kea, Anaina Ho, the Board of Land and Natural Resources. Arguing for the appellants, Richard Wordman. Arguing for the state appellees, Board of Land and Natural Resources, Department of Land and Natural Resources, and Suzanne Case in her official capacity as Chair of the Board of Land and Natural Resources and Director of the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Julie China, Deputy Attorney General. Arguing for appellee, University of Hawaii at Hilo, J. S. Handelin, Carl Smith Ball, LLP. Also appearing for appellee, University of Hawaii at Hilo, Ian L. Sanderson and Tim Louis Kwan, Carl Smith Ball, LLP. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, aloha everyone, and aloha to our audience and also to our attorneys who are here today. Mr. Wordeman, Mr. Handelin, and Ms. China, are you all ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right. My understanding is we'll be going today for approximately an hour and a half. Mr. Wordeman, you'll be going for about 30 minutes and then have reserved 15 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning when we get to the 15 minutes. Mr. Handelin, you'll be going for 30 minutes, so we'll have a warning light come on at 30 minutes, and then we'll go to Ms. China, and she'll get a warning at 43 minutes of the 45 minutes allotted to the appellees. Is that everyone's understanding? Very well. Please proceed, Mr. Wordeman.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, I would like to briefly start today's arguments just describing the important and tremendous significance of Mauna Kea to the Hawaiian people. Mauna Kea is more than a mountain, it is the embodiment of the Hawaiian people. Mauna Kea Kuahiwi Uhawa I Ka Malie. Mauna Kea is an astonishing mountain that stands in the calm. Mary Kavana Kukui, 1983. It's an old saying that expresses the sentiment among the Hawaiian people that Mauna Kea is a source of awe and inspiration. This is, as the court is well aware, one of the most significant and important cultural sites in Hawaii. It is the source of the genealogical story of the Hawaiian people, of Papa and Makea, the creation story. This is the source, this is the piko, this is the beginning for Hawaiian people, for Hawaiian society, for Hawaiian culture. This is the source. And that's, in that light, I'd like to proceed with today's arguments. Unfortunately, given that tremendous significance and cultural aspects with respect to Mauna Kea, Mauna Kea has really become an absolute mess. It's there's been significant adverse impact that's been found. We have what is essentially an industrial center up on top of the conservation district on the summit of Mauna Kea. And this has been going on for many years. It has been the source of scathing audits by the state auditors. I would submit to the court it is a situation that is out of hand. The governor has, as the court is probably aware, recently spoke about the need for better management on Mauna Kea. He has come out with a variety of points that he needs to be addressed, including needing to be better stewards on the mountain. And in all of this, if I may, just briefly overview the process that, this project has gone through. And that has, we started off with a comprehensive management plan that excluded coverage of Mauna Kea. We then had a, and that was in 2009, we then had a application for the conservation district use permit by the University of Hawaii, who interestingly had been carrying a ball for the 30-meter telescope nonprofit corporation throughout these proceedings for whatever reason. And in along with that application that was submitted in September of 2010, there was what was called a management plan, not a comprehensive management plan, that was site-specific to the TMT project, which is on the north ridge of the Mauna Kea, right next to the summit area that's already been overdeveloped with multiple telescopes dating back to the 1960s. And what happened is, subsequent to that application, there was a hearing in which my clients had stated that the Board of Land and Natural Resource can't go forward and, grant this application without first holding contested case hearings. And despite those pleads, the Board of Land and Natural Resources granted the application, and then in that same hearing that followed said, well, we're not gonna give you your chance for a contested case hearing, after they already ruled, albeit what they called a conditional approval, which was essentially nothing more than saying we're gonna stay construction until we hold these contested case hearings. Why would the Board of Land and Natural Resources make a conditional finding to begin with? There's nothing in our rules that allow for it. There's completely arbitrary and capricious. It's really setting a terrible standard for administrative proceedings throughout by setting this trend, it seems, to grant we're gonna give you a permit, but we're gonna give the people that come in and ask for contested case hearing their permit. But don't worry about it. We're gonna rest assured we're giving your permit and we're giving this conditional granting of it.
Mr. Wardham, is there anything that prohibited that process from being done in that way? And I believe there's a rule that allows the board to adopt processes that best serve the purpose of the proceedings as long as they're not prohibited. And my question is there some way in which it's prohibited, and does that rule have any bearing at all in whether this was appropriate or not in your view?
Certainly, due process, a meaningful time in a meaningful manner. And the right to be heard. The right to be heard before a decision is made, before a quote-unquote conditional decision is to be made, that's what's critical here. There was no reason for the board to grant this conditional permit. It was on the same agenda.
Excuse me. Is it a conditional permit? The way I read it, it was a permit. It was issued, and it stayed one process, the construction. But the permit was issued. It's not a conditional permit. It's a permit which has a condition, but that doesn't make it conditional.
Well, that's what it was called, Your Honor, by the board.
But does the permit say it's conditional? Does it say anything in this that says this is a conditional permit?
And they state construction, and certainly they did predispose and predetermine the whole issues before their rights, duties, and privileges of the petitioners were determined, and that's wrong. That's repugnant to due process. That's repugnant to the whole idea of the right to be heard in a meaningful time, at a meaningful time, and in a meaningful manner.
Mr. Werdemann, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I did want to ask you about that point. You were talking about the right to due process, a right to be heard in a meaningful manner. Can you speak a bit about what that means with respect to a contested case hearing? In other words, what sort of rights were you anticipating would apply that would be of significance to your clients in the contested case context? And in that regard, I'm sure you're aware that the position that is taken by the university and the board is that actually you did get a contested case hearing. So can you speak to why, from the point of view of your clients, the due process that they're seeking would suggest that they should be entitled to another contested case hearing?
I would submit, Your Honor, that that again, that the whole idea of due process is to be heard before decisions are made, and to determine the rights, the rights, duties, and privileges were already determined by the Board of Land and Natural Resources even before the contested case hearings were held. The hearings officer was certainly aware of that. There's certainly at a minimum a appearance of improprieties in all of that, and I'm just respectfully submitting that the court set this whole process straight, that if there's a contested case hearing that's going to be held, if the parties have a right to that contested case hearing, that those that contested case hearing be held before any decisions are made by the board. Because the whole purpose of the contested case hearing, again, is to determine first the rights, duties, and privileges of the parties.
Mr. Werdemann, how do you respond to the appellee's proposition that the reason the permit was set forth beforehand was to add more of a form to the arguments? In other words, to give you an opportunity to understand what their thoughts were so that you could better your arguments at the contested case.
I submit that that argument is unfounded, again, that my clients knew what their cultural practices were. They knew what their arguments were with respect to the significance of the cultural and natural and archaeological sites up on the Maunga. That is Justice Wilson, again, in answer to your question, those are the things that we're being deprived of in this predetermination of the issues in this case by the board. But I think the subsequent, I'm sorry.
No. The thing I was going to ask Mr. Werdemann is the process improved or at least a legitimate interest served by having the permit and the conditions of the permit there for the parties to then be able to respond to at the contested case hearing? There are numerous conditions in the permit. Some of them are very specific. And would that give the parties the opportunity to criticize, you know, condition 17, 18, 23, 24, inadequate for the following reasons, they need to be amended, as opposed to just generally responding to the notion that this telescope was going to be built, have actually the permit conditions there to be able to respond to in detail to contested case hearing? Is that a legitimate interest that you think it was served by this process, or would you disagree with that proposition?
I would certainly disagree with that. The application was there for everyone's review. The board didn't have and shouldn't have made it a predetermination of the issue on it. So that would certainly answer the questions presented by you, Mr. Chief Justice, that that this should have gone forward with the contested case hearing, that the board obviously was well aware of that they were going to grant at that hearing. Again, the issues were predetermined.
Is there anything in the rules that say that permits shall be approved before the contested hearing so that the issues can be better understood by the parties?
Well, that's certainly...
I mean, is there anything in the rules like that?
That's certainly part of my objections to all of this process.
And isn't there a procedure for, if you want to set support the issues, 13-129 says the party requesting it shall state explicitly the issues and that the disagreement the requester has with the application, not with the approval, with the application. And 91-9 talks about the requirement of setting forth the issues. There's nothing said, and that's done through a particular notice. That's not done through approving an application before the hearing. Is it? Is there any procedure in the rules that allow this?
No, Your Honor, I would submit it. And even if there was, it, again, it would be repugnant to the due process requirements.
If we were to agree with you, what would your remedy be? Wouldn't it be going back to a board to rehear the same matter again?
I would submit that is the only remedy to address the due process violation. We have a new board, certainly.
This is a completely new board than the one who heard it before?
As far as I'm aware, I may be mistaken, but I believe that most of the board members stepped down with the financial disclosure requirements previously that were implemented by the legislature, and the whole board was appointed. So I think it is a brand new board. There's an opportunity to have a new hearings officer convene as well, and to vet out the issues the way it should have been done in the first place.
Mr. Werdeman, you're focusing understandably on the opportunity for a contested case hearing under 13-129, but I did want to ask you to speak as to your position regarding the discussion that was in the Kela Kela case. I think that Justice Acoba focused on it to some extent as to whether your clients have a constitutional right, a sort of due process right arising from Article 12, Section 7, as well as Article 11 of the Hawaii Constitution. What is your position as to whether the right to a contested case is grounded as well in the Constitution?
I certainly agree with that, and I think it was really undisputed in this case that there was a right to contest a case hearing. It wasn't objected to in any way. The contested case hearing did proceed. I think all of those rights are certainly at issue here, Your Honor. With respect to the elements of Hawaii Administrative Rules 13.5-30, subparagraph C, these are the eight administrative standards that are codified in the rules that must be met in order for a conservation district use permit to be granted. And again, it's undisputed that, and it was set forth in the conclusions of Law 92, that the cumulative effects of astronomical development and other uses in the summit area of Mauna Kea have previously resulted in impacts that are significant and adverse. That's already established. What the appellees seem to argue and what the hearings officer and the board subsequently found was that the Morimoto case, that you can consider mitigation, but the mitigation that was proposed by the university and set forth by the board and found by the board was not the kind of mitigation that was present in Morimoto. It didn't address the issues of how do we deal with the impact of building a highway through a palila bird habitat? And in that case, what they did was, the mitigation was, they set for 10,000 acres of reforestation to better allow for the palila bird survival. What they did in this case is, they came up with, because there's, we would submit, there's nothing really that could be mitigated because it's already overdeveloped up on Mauna Kea. But what they, University of Hawaii did as far as so-called mitigation is that they came up with community benefit packages, workforce projects, some scholarship funds for the community, nothing that dealt with the impact itself in the conservation district. Could I
interrupt you?
Yes.
If I could ask you about this issue of impact that you've just addressed and the idea of a mitigation that would address the impact, so to speak. You've mentioned that there's a determination that's an official determination at this point that there really isn't a substantial adverse impact, correct?
Yeah.
At this point.
Yes.
That idea that there's no substantial adverse impact seems to be based on this approach which you've described as sort of incremental degradation, that the mountain, albeit a significant cultural resource at some point, has been degraded significantly to the point that now it's, with the addition of the telescope, not true to say that there is a substantial adverse impact on the culture, correct? That's the position that's being taken. So if that is the case, Mr. Werdemann, I'm interested in your explanation for how is it that it appears from the testimony of Mr. White and Mr. Hayes, the individuals that put together the conservation use permit, as well as the EIS, the cultural section, their view is that there's been this incremental degradation because of, and there's a list in the cultural section of 21 different actions that have taken place over time, including building telescopes and roads, that according to the testimony of Mr. Hayes anyways, means that the mountain has now been degraded to the point where the addition of a telescope isn't significant. So I wanted to ask you if you could speak to that analysis. Is that the core of the idea that the mountain has been incrementally degraded? The fact that, according to the analysis of Parsons Brinkerhoff in the EIS, that means that there is a substantial adverse impact that is so great that the addition of a telescope won't make any difference?
Certainly, what the university is proposing or is arguing all of this is really that it's already a mess up there. What's a little bit more of a mess?
But how do they come to the specific legal definition that the mess equals such a significant degradation that a telescope doesn't really make a difference at this point?
Well, then as the governor has pointed out, remedial measures need to be taken and started today and years ago. We can't incrementally continue to build up there just because there's a finding of substantial adverse impact. This is a conservation district. This is not an industrial district. This is a conservation district where preserving natural resources is significant, and that's what the legislature has found. And what the university and what the state administration needs to do is start addressing the problem, not continue to add to it.
Mr. Werdemann, in that regard, I noted that the witness who testified for the university regarding who is the author of the application, Mr. Perry White, testified, was asked this question, how can you say that it's not substantial? And one of the things that he pointed to was that there was an expectation some telescopes would be decommissioned and that there would be a rolling back, and that when one considers that over time some of the telescopes would be decommissioned, we felt that it was on balance not a bad thing. Now my question is there anything in the permit that in any way restricts the number of telescopes that can be built on Mauna Kea in the future, or that contains commitments regarding decommissioning of current telescopes?
Well, there's discussion in the finding and an application of putting together a decommissioning plan for PMT. There's really no concrete, legally binding obligations, I would submit right now, that would require the university as the lessee of the Mauna Kea Science Reserve to be required to do those things that you're talking about.
And would those be, in your view, appropriate conditions for a permit? And is the absence of those requirements one of the factors that, in your view, makes this permit improperly granted, or is that not the kind of mitigation that you're seeking in this case?
Well, I think it's something that needs to be considered in the balance during a process that's not predetermined. It's certainly, especially when there's significant and adverse impact already up there. The analysis and the management plans that should have been presented and proposed should have addressed those issues. They should have said, you know, we have this situation up there, how do we address it before we start allowing any more telescope development and continue this significant and adverse impact in this conservation district. So that wasn't done here. That certainly should have at least been considered and discussed in the process. I wouldn't agree that it would necessarily turn out in the end that would allow for the telescope to be built at that point, but it's certainly something that should have been considered.
In your view, in the position of the appellants, what should be done, or are there any combination of conditions that would allow the construction of this telescope, or is it because of the nature of what's already on the mountain, it's precluded as a matter of law in your view?
Well, certainly as it stands today, the telescope should not be built or should not be allowed to be built whatsoever. I think it's a very long and involved process to really sit down and analyze at what point this significant adverse impact becomes less than significant and adverse, and whether the telescope at that point can even be built, again, taking into consideration the cultural, archaeological, natural resources up in this conservation district at Mauna Kea.
So your view would be, if there were limits on telescope construction and or requirements regarding decommissioning, that's something that should be in the discussion, but you cannot say that alone would be enough to make it the impact to the point where you would be able to agree that the test had been met, that there is no substantial impact.
I think it certainly should be in the discussion with respect to picking it less than significant and adverse up on Mauna Kea. That needs to be done before any further development can even be considered. And so that is my
Can you clarify something for me? Now, there was a comprehensive management plan which addressed a broader area of the mountain, and then a TMT-specific management plan. Did either of those plans contain binding requirements related to future development of the mountain in terms of additional telescopes or decommissioning?
Well, they certainly... so-called comprehensive management plan specifically, and it states in section 2.2.3, that's at page 21, record on appeal 42, that it was not considering the 30-meter telescope in that so-called comprehensive management plan. And so what happened is subsequent to that, again in 2010, a site-specific plan was submitted. But at that time, it wasn't even allowed for under the rules. What the rules allowed for was, or required, was that this comprehensive management plan be put together, and it wasn't done. What interestingly happened, and it's really a commentary on this whole process, is that after it was submitted with along with the conservation district use application, and then the hearing in February of 2011 was held. Later that year, the board changes the rules. And they say, oh, you no longer need a comprehensive management plan as long as you have a site-specific management plan. Unless the board finds that a comprehensive management plan is necessary. That's essentially what happened. So this project is being railroaded through. They're predetermining the issues on the granting of the application. They changed the rules to allow it to go forward because obviously the management plan that was submitted with the application was insufficient under the rules.
So in your view, the comprehensive management plan would not have satisfied the rules that existed at the time it was submitted because it did not address the TMT project? Is that the position of the appellants?
Yes, and it should have also addressed the entire impact of the conservation district on Mauna Kea as well, and not just focused on the Mauna Kea Science Reserve.
So which version of the rules should have been applied by the hearing officer and then ultimately the board when the board ruled in 2013? The 2009 version of the rules or the 2011? Because under the 2011 version, there was not a requirement. There was no finding that a comprehensive management plan was required.
Right. I certainly think the pre-2011 issues. I mean, if there's going to be any meaningful review of the conservation district at Mauna Kea, especially with a significant and adverse impact. I mean, let's have a comprehensive management plan that does what it's supposed to do. Because otherwise, we just have all this paper with a bunch of empty promises. And these management plans really don't mean a thing. There's no, again, concrete requirements on decommissioning that are of any note. It's really appalling that the rules were changed the way they were just to get this project moving through and to let them proceed with a management plan that didn't really do what it was supposed to do.
Mr. Wardeman, there are other administrative procedures throughout the state and both the city and the state level whereby a hearings officer can initially hear a matter and then also sit on the panel that reviews it. And we have said that that's okay, absent actual prejudice, actual bias. How is that different in this case?
With
a hearings officer who makes a ruling and then sits on the panel that hears it on appeal.
The hearings officer wasn't...
I'm referring to like Cecil v. City and County.
But in this case, the hearings officer wasn't on the board.
What I'm saying is, although there's a preliminary decision, then the appeal officer is sitting... Isn't this the same board that did the preliminary... that was a hearings officer.
Yes, there was a board that convened. They made a determination on the conservation district permit, use permit. It was then referred to a hearings officer who conducted the contested case hearing. And then subsequently, the board adopted the findings and conclusions of the hearing officer.
Was it the same board that heard the preliminary, what they call the preliminary permit, as the one that heard the contested case hearing?
I'm not sure if all of the board members were the same on the first one that that were present at the time of the confirmation, for lack of a better term. But it was certainly the process that was followed.
Well, I guess the parallel is, why would it be okay for a hearings officer to make an initial determination and then sit on the board, and it not be okay for a board to make the initial determination and then reconsider it also?
Well, I think what's it's more than a predetermination. It's more than what's being presented by Your Honor. This is an approval of the permit that allows them to go forward with the construction on the telescope before we even got started.
But it didn't. In this case, it didn't allow that, though, right? I thought that what was approved specifically precluded construction from beginning.
Right. I mean, that was the only so-called condition that was placed, that you have to wait until the contested case hearings are held before you can move forward, and that's when this subsequent confirmation was held.
The federal courts have cases. I think there's a case called Withrow that we've cited in some of our cases that talks about a medical board that had made a determination there was enough evidence to proceed against a physician with regard to his license, and then that same board adjudicated the case, and that was thought not to be violated of due process, even though one group or the board had made a preliminary determination and then came back and made a final determination. That and other cases cited by the university, they argue that those cases have found that's not a violation of due process. What's your response to that argument?
It certainly is. This isn't a preliminary kind of probable cause determination. This is a granting of the application right from the get-go. I think the fact that they stayed construction, the argument that the appellees are making is that that's not a final decision order for, really for purposes, and this was the issue in Kila Kila, or a primary issue in Kila Kila, was that whether it was an appealable ruling at that point. It didn't change the stakes as far as predetermining the issues. The stay on the construction, that didn't change in any way their predetermination and predisposition of the issues. And finally, I guess I'm out of time. I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
If you want. Yeah.
Okay,
we'll hear from the appellees, and then we'll hear back from you in rebuttal, Mr. Werdemann.
Thank you.
Very well.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chief Justice Recknwell, Justices of Court, may it please the Court, Jay Hanlon, on behalf of the University of Hawaii at Hilo. Your Honors, I would immediately like to address some of the questioning and the characterization about the relationship between the existing state of the mountain and the summit area of the mountain and this project. I think what the voluminous record that underlies the decision of the Board of Land and Natural Resources in this matter shows is that the ultimate final decision of the Board granting the Conservation District use permit represents the culmination of a process of years of community outreach, of dialogue, of listening, revising, reducing, modifying, mitigating, conditioning to a degree that is unprecedented in the history of astronomy on Mauna Kea.
Mr. Hammonds, except for the stay on the construction, how is this not Kila Kila all over again?
Well, Your Honor, I think that certainly this court's Kila Kila decision, I think, turned on the fact, or turned largely on the fact, that as the court read the record, that construction was permitted to go forward there, and here it is not. I think there's a fundamental issue. There's a practical consideration here for agencies to function in an orderly manner, and that is that sometimes the reality is, I think the court can take judicial notice, sometimes agencies deny permit applications. Until an agency votes on an application, it is not known whether the permit is going to be granted or not. And certainly it is not known if the agency may condition a permit going forward on what. So indeed, if in every instance where somebody makes a request for a contested case before the agency has voted on an application, then you have to stop everything, hold the contested case, and the agency could be waving their hands and saying, we're going to deny that one. You don't have to go bother
now,
with a contested case. Or we may. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Hanlon, for pointing that out, because it does seem that the gist of the argument from the point of view of the university is that this process of having a decision ahead of time before the contested case is useful. It's useful because it saves time for, I guess, the agency, but I don't think that's the primary focus that you're talking about. Mostly, you're saying it aids the parties. It gives them the benefit of knowing what the agency's going to do ahead of time. Correct?
Correct.
That's your point.
Correct.
And when you consider a case such as this, where you have 85 witnesses testify, many of them are saying we want a contested case hearing. It's a regular theme that goes all the way through from December of 2011 all the way up to the next year, the 25th, when you're having a hearing. It doesn't, in this case, necessarily serve the interests of the community, I guess, right? Because you have an idea that they've thought it through. And if you consider what they give up, a contested case hearing means that you have an opportunity as the participant requesting the hearing for testimony that's under oath. You can cross-examine, and you get an opportunity to therefore focus on the evidence in front of the decision maker, hopefully causing them to make a decision in your favor. You forfeit that opportunity if the decision is made ahead of time, right? So your interests that you're describing on behalf of the public, in that you give them the benefit of knowing what the decision is going to be so they can decide whether to have a contested case or not, do you really think that that outweighs the interests of a member of the public of getting those extra due process protections and being able to present the evidence before a board that hasn't made a decision yet?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that there is any additional due process protection. I think process that was due and above and beyond was afforded here.
Well, that may be your point of view, but under the law, the difference between the legislative context where you have a public hearing and the quasi-judicial context where the board is sitting in a contested case under the law is considered to provide greater due process protections. That's just the settled law.
And indeed, Your Honor, let's remember again what happened here. It is not simply on February 25, 2011, not simply the addition of the condition of the stay in construction pending the outcome of the conclusion of the contested case and the board rendering its final decision. It is the board then immediately on its own motion.
Actually, though, the board had written at least one written petition requesting a contested case hearing even before it's ruled on its own motion, correct? Yeah. Now, in terms of due process, as I think Justice Wilson has pointed out, administrative agencies can have different functions. They're usually creatures of statute, or sometimes by the Constitution will call for an agency. But they're usually creatures of statutes, and their roles and functions are pointed out and governed by law, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And so in this case, the administrative agency was ruling in a quasi-judicial function. In terms of the contested case hearing, it is a quasi-judicial function, not an executive function or a legislative function, which is the rulemaking function of an administrative agency. In terms of a quasi-judicial proceeding, this court has said in Cecil that there are certain fundamentals of just procedure which are the same for every type of tribunal and every type of proceeding. A fair trial in a fair tribunal is a basic requirement of due process. This applies to administrative agencies which adjudicate as well as to courts. The Supreme Court teaches us, and this is the United States Supreme Court, that justice can perform its high function in the best way only if it satisfies the appearance of justice. Justice must not only be done, but manifestly be seen to be done. So, if an administrative agency is dealing in a quasi-judicial function, it's acting in a way in which a court would act. Do you think that due process would allow a court, for example, in a trial, in a situation in which a plaintiff files a lawsuit, for the judge to say, here is my judgment in favor of the plaintiff. We will now have a trial. And if you convince me otherwise, I'll change my mind.
Well, Your Honor, let me answer your question in two parts. The first is that I think the question makes a presupposition which I wonder about, and that is, I don't know that an agency's decision of whether and when to hold a contested case is the agency acting in a quasi-judicial function. Certainly, once the agency makes its decision, that is quasi-judicial. But then let me get to the second part of your question. And respectfully, Your Honor, I think courts actually do exactly that all the time. And that is, for example, in the context of a preliminary injunction application.
But those, how often do you get a mandatory injunction? I thought that might be your argument. In a preliminary injunction situation, it is a situation which courts are stopping people from taking action, not allowing people to take action. And in terms of the law, contested case is defined under the law, under 91(1) of the Hawaii Revised Statute, as a proceeding in which the legal rights, duties, or privileges of specific parties are required by law to be determined after an opportunity for an agency hearing, not before. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, first of all, the fact that mandatory injunctions are rare, they do occur.
Was this a mandatory injunction setting?
No, Your Honor. The question I'm simply trying to say, this is akin, in trying to respond to Justice McKenna's question, simply courts routinely are presented with situations when they are called upon to make a preliminary determination on the merits.
I was a trial judge for a long time. I don't recall ever making a decision where I just decided the case before the trial.
No, Your Honor. And indeed, that didn't happen here.
I think it did. Well, at least the argument can be made. The permit was issued.
You had a permit that said, essentially, this permit cannot be acted upon.
And no, it can only, that's not what it said.
And
what
it can only ever be acted upon after a contested case hearing is held, if the university prevails, and then after the BLNR, following the contested case, the full contested case hearing that the BLNR itself ordered be held, is resolved in favor, that the BLNR renders a final decision in favor of the application going forward. So the permit...
The permit actually approved the TMT management plan, did it not?
It did.
And that certainly was a condition. So you only have one condition in this entire permit that is stayed. And a stay is complete, is something completely different than conditioning something. It just means that here's your permit, and you cannot go forward with one specific item.
And Mr. Hanlon, I might mention in that regard, if you're responding to your view that this actually is something other than a permit, that the permit, this is the March 3rd, 2011, you could call it a permit, but it's a notice to the University of Hawaii. The provision 10 says the following additional conditions shall be implemented by OMKM and TMT. And then there are, I don't know, 19, 20 different conditions that follow after that. This doesn't include a stay. But the characterization of this as something other than a permit, I think, might be difficult because Mr. Lemo, in his submittal, recommends approval. Board Member Pacheco recommends a vote, an official vote, on the staff recommendation, and they vote in favor of the staff recommendation. Later, after the vote, and before the board makes its decision on the contested case hearing, again, Mr. Lemo characterizes it as a final determination. So the idea that this is something other than a permit, I think, would be difficult given in light of the facts.
Your Honor, if I said anything that suggested that I thought it wasn't a permit, then I misspoke or I wasn't clear. It certainly, as it states on its face, it is a permit, but it is a permit on which the applicant could do nothing.
Well, he could follow through. The applicant could have followed through on at least condition 10 that has about 20 subparts. There are a number of things that could have done. Ensuring that employees attend mandatory cultural and natural resource training, I suppose they could have pursued that, but there are any number of the provisions that seems to me potentially could have been pursued. They weren't stayed.
What I think the record is completely clear, because again, we did go ahead and have a full-blown formal contested case hearing, and the record is clear that nothing with respect to the project actually went forward pending the outcome of the contested case hearing, the resolution, the resubmission back to the Board of Land and Natural Resources, which the board itself in April of 2013 took the view that it was deciding this all over again.
And Mr. Hanlon, yes, as Mr. Wardler points out, nothing in the rules allows a preliminary decision. So just because it's not disallowed, is that a good enough reason to go ahead and do it?
Your Honor, HRS 9114A does contemplate preliminary rulings of the nature that deferral of review and entry of subsequent final decision would not deprive the appellant of adequate relief.
Let's take a look at that provision. What's the title of that provision? You have it in front of you, 9114.
Yes, Your Honor, it says judicial review of contested cases. And if we read the sentence, it says A, any person aggrieved by a final decision and order in a contested case.
So that's the caption is judicial review of contested cases. In other words, it applies to contested cases. And in the Pash case, it specifically interpreted that provision. And what it said in that case is, in the necessary inquiry, therefore, is whether Pash has met the requirements of 91-14. First, the proceeding that resulted in the unfavorable action must have been a contested case hearing. It's not even, the preliminary ruling doesn't even apply unless it's a contested case hearing. And that there's another case that comes after it and explains, for example, preliminary ruling in a contested case hearing would be a situation This is from an HGA case where the party sought intervention in a contested case, and that was a preliminary ruling. So the preliminary ruling that you're trying to rely upon applies only to the contested case hearing. And what you're trying to say is that the approval of the plan, approval of the permit, was a preliminary ruling. There was no contested hearing at that time.
Your Honor, if I could refer back to the actual words of 9114A, it says, A, any person aggrieved by a final decision and order in a contested case, or by a preliminary ruling of the nature, it does not then follow in parallel and say a preliminary ruling in a contested case. So
I'm reading from Passion. There's another case which interprets the provision and the title of the section. So what they're referring to is preliminary rulings in a contested case.
I understand, Your Honor. I just think that the precise language of the statute here suggests that preliminary rulings with respect to contested case.
Well, assuming the statute in some sense recognizes there can be such a thing as a preliminary ruling, do these regulations, to follow up on Justice Nakayama's questions, provide sufficient specificity to authorize the process that was followed here? Do they provide any guidance for the exercise of discretion? Do they provide fair notice to parties when they come into a proceeding like this as to what the rules are going to be, in terms of what's going to happen if they do ask for a contested case hearing, or is that a matter of unfettered discretion for the agency? And should there be explicit authorization, and is it there?
You know, Your Honor, one can always hypothesize a situation where a rule provides greater detail, greater specificity, and it's particularly easier to do that with the benefit of hindsight. I think if we look at what actually happened here, I think everybody knew precisely what the rules were, what the situation was. And in fact,
when you say everybody, as I recall at that specific meeting, they were told by at least three individuals, and there was also a letter from the Sierra Club saying, look, you guys can't do this.
And Your Honor, when the petitioners went ahead and they filed their written requests for a contested case hearing, they specifically included in their petitions, they said, we think that issue, the sequencing issue, was done wrong, and we think that is an issue that should be and can be addressed in the contested case proceeding. The petitions say that.
One of the parties had already requested in writing, had filed a petition for a contested case hearing before the February 25th ruling. Let me ask you this. In terms of Kila, this court said that a contested case, this was the conclusion, a contested case hearing should have been held as required by law and properly requested by Kilakila Uhaleakala on UH's application prior to BLNR's vote on the application. Isn't that pretty clear?
Your Honor, I think if we only read that sentence out of the decision, then which is what the appellants here choose to do, but I think that respectfully, I think that disregards the entire context of the decision, which focuses on whether or not the vote that was taken in that case was final agency action, and the court's consideration that in that case it was final agency action because it had allowed construction to go forward. So,
and the context of that case was that the contested case hearing request had been denied and the permit had been granted.
Actually, no, Your Honor. The requests for contested case were not acted upon until 2 months afterwards.
Right, and the permit issued.
And after the vote was taken and the permit issued.
Right.
The contested case requests hadn't been decided yet. The petitioners in that matter immediately ran to court, filed an appeal. The appeal was dismissed, and they were told you can't be in court because you don't have any right to be, and that was the issue that was decided in Kilakila. It totally doesn't exist here.
I noticed in Kilakila, it appears that a new permit actually issued after the contested case hearing.
Yes.
In this case, did a new permit issue?
Yes, sir.
It did?
Yes, sir.
Does it have a different number?
No, and I believe that and Ms. Chena may be able to speak better to this than I, but I believe that in Kila Kila, the new permit that issued carried the same file number. But I think the agency's final action in April 2013 here characterizes it as a new permit. And I think that essentially it's effectively the same thing as happened in Kila Kila.
I guess my question would be, could the board have decided not to vote on the permit and instead just order the contested case hearing under the rules as you understand them?
Would the board have done that?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, and so in your view, it had the discretion to do either?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and is there anything in the rules that tells the board about how it should exercise that discretion or how we should assess whether that discretion is being used in a way that's appropriate and consistent with the intent of the statute?
I don't think the rules speak to it one way or the other.
Okay, and should they? Or must they?
I don't think they must. Again, here I think the board manifested its sensitivity by immediately saying, just to address Justice McKenna has now raised it twice, that before the February 25, 2011 hearing, there was a written request for a contested case under DLNR's rules of practice and procedure. To perfect a request for a contested case, there must actually be both an oral and a written request.
Really?
Yes. And again, Ms. Chena, I think, is better positioned to speak to that than I, but that's my understanding. And with respect, that was the Flores, I think Mr. Flores's or the Flores case, Ohana's 13 request for contested case.
Actually, it can be an oral or written made before the close of the meeting, and then after the meeting there has to be a written request.
Well, so the sequencing, the fact that beforehand a request is made, it is not perfected until subsequent to the meeting there is a written request. So the fact that the request was made prior to the hearing alone does not perfect the request for a contested case under the DLNR's rules. But Chief Justice Recknell, going to your question, I think, again, the board here was under no compulsion to, on its own motion, order a contested case. Yes, there had been requests made, but as, in fact, there were some requests that were made that people did not follow through on. The board said, we think this case is of sufficient importance that we are directing that it be held on our own motion no matter what, which is my understanding.
Mr. Hunman, under your interpretation of the rules then, unless there is a decision, you said that there has to, in order to perfect the request for a contested case hearing, there must be a, you're shaking your head no.
No, I again, if I misspoke, I apologize. No, there must be, as Justice Pollack points out, first an oral or written request,
right,
followed up after the meeting.
After the meeting.
Because
you said decision.
Oh.
But you meant
sorry,
meeting.
After the meeting.
All right.
Yes, I apologize.
Well, that is an interesting point about whether the request is made at the end of the meeting or before the decision's made, because the rule does provide that the request can be made to the board no later than the close of the board meeting, at which the subject matter of the request is scheduled for board disposition. Now, feel free to add to your explanation as to why the board goes through the procedure of making a decision before following through with a contested case. But my understanding is your position is they do it for the benefit of the party so they can know what's going to happen ahead of time. From that point of view, this rule anticipates the possibility that a party could attend the hearing, let the vote take place, and before the hearing's finished, say that a contested case is being requested. So, in that situation at least, the purpose is accomplished, and it's accomplished in a manner in which the opponent to the permit is given notice. So it's not as though it's necessary for the land board to make the decision prior to the contested case hearing in order to alert the public as to what it's going to do. In this case, if you talk about the exercise of discretion, though, it's very interesting. I mean, Mr. Ching filed his request nearly a year before the December 25th hearing, and then subsequently there were requests made. And then during the course of the testimony, there was testimony from... And again, this goes, I think, to Justice McKenna's point about the need to have an appearance that's focused in the Sussel case, where it says justice must not only be done, but must manifestly be seen to be done. You have testimony from Mr. Honoloa Halela, who says it seems like a done deal by the time they got to these hearings. Kealoha Pisciota says, if you make your decision before you grant the contested case hearing, it will force us into two courts. We'll go into contested case hearings, but we will also have to address the permit itself. And Marty Townsend specifically says, it's a process for you to collect information because in these kinds of cases, we only have 5 minutes to speak. We don't get to cross-examine witnesses. So having had... at that time, 90 witnesses testify, specific requests for contested case hearing, and concerns that, in line with what Justice McKenna is talking about, concerns about the integrity of the process. The only reason the land board decided to deny the request of the many individuals requesting contested case hearings before a decision was made, the only reason for them to do that was so that they could explain to the public what their decision was going to be ahead of time?
Again, Your Honor, the state may be in a better position to speak to the state, but I do want to add, I believe that the land board felt first that they were following FOIA Administrative Rules Section 13.128B, under which it says the contested case hearing shall be held after any public hearing which by law is required to be held on the same subject matter. I understand that that rule does not address one way or the other about any decision being made at that hearing, but the sequence, the meeting, and then the contested case.
Do you think they were relying on Section 13.128B when they decided to make the vote?
I say that doesn't address one way or the other the
vote.
Well,
it does in a sense, because it says the contested case hearing shall be held after any public hearing. The way the board interpreted this, or the way they read it, the contested case hearing shall be held after any public hearing and approval of the application. That's what they did. That's the way you folks was read, which, of course, it doesn't say that.
Well, and again, Your Honors, if, presumably, if the land board had voted to deny the permit.
Was that a real viable potentiality when there was a lengthy report from the staff recommending? Was that really an issue that they were going to deny it at that point in time?
First,
And wouldn't the applicant then be able to ask for a contested hearing as well?
The applicant could ask. I think what usually happens is applicants go back to the drawing board. But again, I think the land board, you know, it's in the record that there was public scoping meetings in Hilo and Kona on December 2 and 3, 2010. And at the December 2, 2010 meeting in Kona, there were at that meeting, which Mr. Lemo presided over, there were numerous requests made then for a contested case hearing. So in part, I think the land board, and again, Ms. Chino may speak to this, the land board feels like, you know, I think Justice Wilson pointed out that Mr. Ching had made a request apparently a year in advance. At what point do you stop and say, well, do we have the contested case a year before, in December, in February? The decision gives a focal point to say, here's when to have it, and here is exactly what the parties can address.
Well,
so,
there's a focal point that normally happens during the course of a contested case and during the course of a public hearing, as obviously you're pointing out that they're different. But initially, the land board holds a public hearing until people are done testifying. And then there's an identifiable endpoint when the hearing's ended. The chairman says the hearing's over.
Your Honor, I come back to the fact that after what occurred on February 25, written requests for a contested case are submitted. The written requests say, we object to this sequencing issue, this timing issue, and we want the issue decided in the contested case.
There's no guarantee that there'll even be a contested case, correct?
The board had ordered it.
But before it, as you said, there has to be a written request, and there's a standing hearing, which they had. So if everyone had been denied standing, there would not even have been a contested case hearing.
Actually, I believe that the rules provide that the board itself could be a party in a contested case hearing.
But the board required them to, if I remember right, it told them they had to submit written submissions, and they and the hearing officer had a standing hearing to determine who had standing.
If I could, Mr. Hanlon, I'd like to get your answer to the question that I asked Mr. Werdemann regarding a lack of conditions in the permit regarding construction or limits on construction in the future or decommissioning. Would you agree that there are no binding conditions in that regard in the permit? And if so, why should there be or must there be in order to address the issue of substantial impact? And did the board clearly err in approving the permit without those conditions being there?
I would agree, Your Honor, that the conditions in the permit do not address that. Well, it does not say those words in the permit, but the permit does, the conditions of the permit do require that the university comply with all of the requirements of the comprehensive management plan and its subplans, which include the decommissioning plan. The decommissioning subplan.
But those are all aspirational. There's no binding commitment in there that says certain telescopes will be decommissioned and no new telescope will be built except in certain circumstances.
Well,
is that right?
There are recitations in the decommissioning plan that by the end of the lease term, I believe some number of telescopes would be decommissioned. There's also restrictions on in the decommissioning plan.
So those are factual. In fact, the university, part of its argument, and I think it was Mr. White, said, you know, we believe there is an acceptable level of impact because big picture, there are going to be fewer telescopes on the mountain. There's going to be sort of a drawback, scaling down of what's on the mountain. Do you recall that testimony? Okay, now, but is that in any way a binding condition of this permit, that there be such a rollback, I think is the word he used?
It is not contained in the permit as a binding condition.
Okay. And would the university have any objection to having a commitment like that in the permit?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Because really all of our time has been taken up with due process, we haven't gotten to speak since I've been up here on this issue of existing impacts, and I think.
No, could I? Yeah, thank you. Could I ask your view? I'd ask Mr. Werdemann as well in terms of existing impacts. Would it be your understanding that the analysis that was developed in the final EIS by Parsons Brinckerhoff has to do with the idea that there's an incremental degradation of the mountain that's happened to such a degree that there's a substantial adverse impact on the cultural resource as it stands now? Would you agree with that?
The EIS says that the existing conditions are the existing impacts from historical activity on the mountain.
But applying, I think,
significant, adverse, and substantial.
As it should have, the EIS did apply the standard in 13.530, Section C, and I'm talking about number four, factor four, as to whether there's been a substantial adverse impact to existing natural resources. And they looked at it and said the existing natural resources have now gotten to the point where they have a substantial adverse impact on the culture. Cultural resources, correct?
Your Honor, you may have misspoken. The EIS applied the standards of 11212.
Well, the EIS addresses this particular factor. I mean, I have the EIS here. It says this is 3.16.6. From a cumulative perspective, the impact of past, present, and the project, together with other reasonable, foreseeable future actions on cultural resources, is substantial, significant, and adverse. So the language does seem to track the particular statute. But to finish the point, and then it says, having found that there's a substantial, significant, and adverse impact on the cultural resource, it says, in general, the project will add a limited increment to the level of cumulative impact, but will not tip the balance. That's what I was going to try to get your thoughts on. Will not tip the balance of any specific cumulative impact from a less than significant level to a significant level. So my question was, how did they calculate this tipping on the balance? It's a little unclear to me.
Well, Your Honor, first, I think there's a material difference between the EIS standards, which are in 11212, which expressly require the analysis and the disclosure of cumulative impact, versus the express language of the eight criteria, and specifically the fourth criterion, 13530C4. 13530C4 says the proposed land use, not things that have happened before plus the proposed land use, will not cause substantial adverse impact to existing natural resources, not to natural resources as at some past pristine point in history may have existed, to existing natural resources within the surrounding area, community, or region.
Well, I think we're saying essentially the same thing, because if you look at the Land Board's decision, it relies on this incremental degradation analysis to say that the mountain was so degraded that it already had a substantial adverse cultural impact at the time that the telescope was going to be built. That was the finding, the conclusion of law of the Board.
I think, Your Honor, that the Board...
And then they found, like the analysis in the final EIS, that the telescope doesn't make that much difference. It might mean that there's an incremental increase in the adverse impact, but it's not so significant that it could be considered by itself substantial. I think that was the analysis.
Yes,
correct me if I'm wrong.
I think the reason that the Board got there was because it looked at the very, very, very extensive mitigation measures that had been undertaken here, starting with the location of the project. Again, this is a project that went through the design of the project, has gone through enormous modification, reduction.
I don't disagree that mitigation became important. I'm just interested in your thoughts about the underlying analysis, that the incremental degradation was so great that a telescope wouldn't make a difference.
I don't think that the Board said that any telescope would have made no difference. I think that it said that this telescope, well, I think the fact that...
I agree with you. They were focusing on TMT. They're focusing on the site and making observations such as the fact that the telescope couldn't be seen from Pu'ulilihoi, it couldn't be seen from the summit, it couldn't be seen from Lake Waiau. Also, there was an explanation that there wasn't that much historical significance to the area where the telescope is. But in that regard, I don't know if you've seen this interesting exhibit that was to the management plan, but figure 5.1 has identified the historic properties that are within the management area, which is quite a large area, and obviously includes the Mauna Kea Science Reserve. But even within the Mauna Kea Science Reserve, there are hundreds of historic properties, which apparently were not considered to be significant historic properties, but nonetheless, the idea that you have this sort of open space that doesn't have any significance.
No, Your Honor.
Is interesting.
You've got an 11,000 plus acre Mauna Kea Science Reserve. In that 11,000 plus acres, you've got 263 identified historical properties. You've got a 525 acre astronomy precinct. Within the astronomy precinct, I think you've got 7 or 8 or 9 historic properties. Within the project area, you have the nearest historic site.
But we're sort of saying the same thing. When you look at it, it depends on what perspective you want to take. You can narrow it to just the science reserve. You can look at the mountain as a whole. But the choice of Parsons Brinckerhoff was to look at it in a certain way that developed the theory of, in their view, in accordance with the law, but developed the theory of this incremental degradation. But it all comes from, I think, where they focus on the mountain. That's sort of the basis of it. And it is a point that you make in your amicus that this is a very limited area. It's 1.2% of the Mauna Kea Science Reserve, 11,288 acres. 5 acres of it is only 1.2%. So, again, you could look at it that way. I would not say that the UH is taking the position that just because it's 5 acres, 1.2% of 11,000 acres, it's insignificant in terms of just the actual size. But that does get a lot of emphasis in your brief, so maybe you can talk about that. What difference does it make that this telescope is in such a small area of the mountain?
Well, and indeed, Your Honor, and I think that the approach that was taken, the analysis of the impacts, was largely driven by the words of the 8 criteria. So if you look, for example, I think it's the 5th criteria that specifically directs that you look at the compatibility of the project with the locality and surrounding areas appropriate to the physical conditions and capabilities of the specific parcel or parcel. But
it is interesting. You know, you look at the Section 4, it says within the surrounding area, community, or region. So Parsons Brinckerhoff decided to look at a certain area. And then they, I guess, developed the incremental degradation concept from there. And I agree. It's kind of a broad notion. What is the surrounding area, the existing natural resource within the surrounding area, community, or region?
Your Honor, in my view, properly read, I think the board's very long, very detailed, fairly comprehensive decision addresses things on a micro, on a wider, and on a macro level. I think they look at the entire mountain. I think they look at, they certainly focus specifically on the project site because the rules direct them to, but I think they absolutely do look more broadly than that. For example, in assessing any impacts on cultural practices, they don't just look at the project site where there are no documented cultural practices.
I think your point couldn't be better made than what actually happened when they decided to analyze the cumulative impact conclusions, because they look at the whole mountain and they have at least 20 different activities that have taken place. So that's true. But they look at the whole mountain in terms of the degradation that's taken place. I'm not sure how much they focus on other issues that might have to do with cultural activity. It's pretty clear, though, that their definition of cultural activity is that there's a limited amount of cultural activity that would suggest that the degradation that's taken place culturally is not that significant if you add the telescope.
I think, just to answer that question,
what I'm going to do, because we've gone quite a bit over in our question and the course has been going for about an hour and a half now, what I'm going to do is let us take a brief recess, and when we come back, we'll have you answer that question, wrap up, if any final thoughts, and we'll hear from the state and we'll hear from Mr. Wardeman in rebuttal. So we'll take about a 5-minute recess at this point. Thank you.
Right. Honorable Supreme Court, we call recess. State of Hawaii is now reconvened.
All right, Mr. Hanlon, I think you were in the midst of answering a question, so you can respond to that question and then give us any brief final comments before we move to Ms. Chena for her argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, Justice Wilson, I wanted to note that the assessment of cultural impacts here, of impact on cultural practices, was in no way dependent upon the existence of pre-existing impacts on the mountain, because if there's a determination that there are no cultural practices in the project areas, the state of things elsewhere on the mountain, frankly, just doesn't come into play. So I just wanted to respond to that. And then, Your Honors, to wrap up, three very short points. First, again, what we have here, February 25, 2011, was not final agency action. The board told us it was not final agency action. They said that in February 2011. They said that in April 2013, when, after the contested case hearing, they issued a new conservation district use permit, which imposed new conditions that were not present in the earlier permit. And they said that that new permit was their final agency action.
What were those new conditions?
Your Honor, respectfully, I cannot tell you.
One of the new conditions, let me refer you to on the decision and order, and it's a parenthetical that was added between, because the conditions that were listed, that were set forth between the granting of the permit and the re-granting of the same permit, one of the only things that was changed was this parenthetical. I'm looking at the decision and order, and it's number 4. Do you have it in front of you?
No, I don't.
It's on page 122, but I'm not sure if your numbering is the same as mine. This is a provision that talks about worker construction to be done. And worker construction is required to be done within 2 years. And this parenthetical was added to that initial condition. And this is what it said in the parenthetical. Such periods shall exclude any time when final approval and implementation of the CDUP is stayed. So the board's final findings reference the permit that was given 2 years earlier as a final approval and states the implementation. And not only that, there would be no necessity of even having to exclude that period if somehow that initial approval was invalid. That's why they had to put in this additional stay. Again, so even the reference is to a final approval.
Actually, again, Your Honor, and it's cited in our briefs, that the board's final decision and order expressly recites, I believe in more than one place, that this is its final agency action. What you have here is a situation of an agency, an administrative agency, applying its own administrative rules promulgated by that agency.
Okay, can I just interrupt? I just want to ask that we not film in the room here, so those of you who have cell phones and the like, if you please don't use them to film. And, sir, I don't know if you're filming over there, but I just ask if you would to not use your phone for that purpose. That's our rules. All right, because thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize that other than the official photographers, we don't allow filming here. So thank you very much, sir, for your explanation. Please continue.
So again, Your Honor, to conclude, we don't have final agency action until April of 2013. That's under the standards recited by this court in Kila Kila, in Blake, in Kelberg. We have an agency that needs the flexibility to interpret its own rules as to which it is charged to have the expertise rules that it has promulgated.
Mr. Hanlon, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to ask you about your response to Justice Pollack's question about number 4 on the decision and order.
Yes, sir.
Is your response that then the parenthetical is referring to this decision and order as the final approval that may be stayed? Is that what your response meant?
What I meant to say, I do know that within this document recites somewhere expressly, this is the agency's final agency action. To the extent that there is internal inconsistency, there may be internal inconsistency within this document, I think the agency's express recitation that its view, that what it had done in February 2011 was a preliminary ruling and that this in any event was its final agency action, whatever the Latin phrase is, the more specific governs.
This is pretty specific between their final decision and order, and it's excluding a time period that it wouldn't even have to exclude unless there was something, a valid document that they were trying to provide an exception to.
And Mr. Hanlon, if you do compare the permit of March 11th to the decision and order, it's quite similar. So the notion that there was a change in the decision would be difficult given the similarity of the two.
Well, again, Your Honor, you have, and I apologize, I do believe that it is cited in our brief, the specific place in here where this recites, in the agency's view, this is its final agency action. On that anticlimactic note, I will thank the court for these.
Thank you. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Hanlon. Now we'll hear from Ms. Chena, and since we went over on the time for Mr. Hanlon, we'll give you the 10 minutes that we had allotted to you, Ms. Chena.
Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Justices of the Court, and may it please the Court. Today, and for decades prior to today, Native Hawaiian cultural practices, nature, recreation, and astronomy have all coexisted on Mauna Kea. For over 7 years since its inception in 2008, the 30-meter telescope project has received the highest and indeed unprecedented level of input, scrutiny, and process. All constituencies, including cultural practitioners and environmentalists, have had their views solicited, considered, and incorporated in planning meetings, consultations, public hearings, land board meetings, and in the contested case hearing. As a result, in order for this telescope to see the light of day, or more specifically, the stars at night, the university will have to comply with the terms of the Conservation District Use Permit, the TMT Management Plan, the Comprehensive Management Plan, the Cultural Resources Management Plan, the Public Access Plan, the Natural Resources Management Plan, and the Decommissioning Plan.
I'm sorry. Well, I was going to ask if you would, as counsel on behalf of the board, address the question of the authority of the board to proceed as it did in this matter, issuing the permit before the contested case hearing. Is that authorized explicitly under the rules? Does it need to be authorized explicitly under the rules? Why is that an acceptable practice, and how does it comport with due process?
Generally, at board meetings, because the rule 13129 requires both an oral or written request followed after the and it's required during the meeting at which the board makes is supposed to make its decision. That's what the rule says, and then it's supposed to be followed up within 10 days. With a written petition. And so because of that, in general, I would say 95% of the cases, possibly more times, we don't get an oral, even an oral request until after the board rules, because they can take the opportunity to make that request prior until the end of that particular meeting. Also,
well, are you saying then that a request after the decision is still considered, even though the rules require an oral or written request before the end of the meeting at which the matter is scheduled for decision?
It's required before the end of that particular board meeting.
Right.
It is not required before the end of the particular matter that is up for board consideration. So in a lot of situations, for example, if you have a penalty, the person who is facing a fine will wait until after the board says, okay, we're gonna you know, fine you X, and then before the end of that meeting, they'll say, well, I want a contested case hearing, and then the chair will usually remind that person, be sure to follow up with a written petition.
So that is a situation in which the board is exercising its executive function and then switches to its judicial function,
yes,
with an investigative power, and then to go ahead. So are you saying that at that time then, in those situations, the board actually says, okay, here is the document, here is our charge, instituting the fine, and now we'll have a contested case hearing?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Let me ask you this. When did the board start adopting that procedure? Because I understand that until 2009, your rules said that a request for a contested case hearing had to be made by the end of the public hearings, if a public hearing was required. And if a public hearing wasn't required, then the request had to be made by the end of the decision-making hearing. Okay? So before 2009, I'm assuming people made requests during or by the time of the public hearing. So when did the board start this procedure that we're going to go ahead and make a decision and then have a contested case hearing?
I believe that for the time that I have been advising the Board of Land and Natural Resources, they have been making decisions and then considering contested case hearings. And in instances where penalties are instituted, there has been no, you know, effort to collect on the penalty.
Can I interrupt just on one point? If I could try to add to the question, Mr. Lemo, one of the administrators for the department, was asked at the hearing whether the board could rule on the permit, and his discussion, it appears to be a reference to the change in that rule, that it used to be that the request for a hearing had to be made at the time of the public hearing, but the rules have now changed, and it's not until the end of the board decision-making hearing that the request had to be made. And he argued that change was, in essence, one of the things that authorized the board to go forward and rule. Do you agree with that argument or not? Do you know what I'm talking about, first of all?
Vaguely.
All right.
And I believe that the current present rules do allow what the board did. But in light of the decision, this court's decision in Kila, the board has been tried to be even more conservative in its approach to addressing the issue of finality. And in this particular situation, it was never the intent of the board to have a final decision whereby UH could go and build their telescope. Because at the very same meeting, the board on its own
said, you know, without even considering any of the applications or requests for a contested case hearing, they said, we are going to hold a contested case hearing.
I'm sorry, but you're not under our law, it was very clear that at least some of these requesters had a right to contested case hearing, right? So therefore, it's not like the board was doing something unusual. And in fact, there was at least one written request already for a contested case hearing, correct?
That is correct. However, well, there was no perfected contested case hearing, I don't think, at the board meeting. Because the facts
You can't
were,
perfect it till afterwards. It
no,
takes
no, no,
both.
No. I think if in Kila Kila, for example, they made both oral requests and written requests early and often. So they had a bunch of oral and written requests. And at that point, under the Kila Kila case, I think the board should have just said, okay, we're gonna hold this contested case. However, in this particular case, we had
some. Can I read you your own rules? Your own rules say that it has to be both oral, written, must be made no later than the close of the board meeting, and then it also says, an agency or person so requesting must also file a written petition with the board no later than 10 calendar days after the close of the board meeting. I'd like to ask you something else, and that is, let's suppose that the university had not prevailed at the contested hearing. What would you have done with the permit that had already been issued?
Well, the new permit basically supplanted the old.
If they did not prevail
at the contested case hearing, the board would have voted to deny a permit.
But the permit was granted. There was one condition stated, and I'm reading from one of your rules. It says revocation of permits in any case where a permittee has failed to comply with any of the conditions contained in a permit, the board may direct the chairperson to revoke the permit. That hadn't occurred, because even if the stay was in effect, they hadn't failed to comply. So you couldn't revoke a permit under that provision. And I'm quoting from Justice Nakayama's majority opinion in Kila Kila. Furthermore, as KOH argued, and I'm quoting, nothing in BLNR's rules would allow it to first grant a conservation district use permit, second, conduct a formal contested hearing, and then revoke the conservation district use permit. And then Justice Coben, the minority, says the same thing. As KOH argued, there's nothing in the rules that would provide for a revocation of the permit in the event that KOH prevailed at the contested case hearing. In fact, I think the only way you can revoke it is if you go to court. And then I was trying to think through this, that you would go to court and say, Judge, would you please revoke the permit that we just issued because we improperly issued it?
I think that the board did have the power and authority to revoke the permit. But more importantly, I think
Can you point to a provision? We actually have cases, some of them 40 or 50 years old, the Yamada case, which actually talks about this. And
when the board looked at the permit, it was looking at it with new eyes. It's as if when a court has a trial, they look at the facts with new eyes, even if they have previously ruled on a motion for summary judgment or anything else. Also,
there is a specific provision for reconsideration, which I think you're talking about. This wasn't a reconsideration. This was a revocation, which you're arguing that you had the right, because that permit was already issued.
No, the permit was not issued. This was a preliminary consideration of the permit.
And I think that if this was a final determination of the permit, then at that point in time, petitioners hadn't had a right to appeal. Time for appeal expired long ago.
So
they had 30 days after that. If they considered that the decision, that point, they should have appealed 30 days within the 2011 decision. And also, the remedy that was granted in Kila Kila was only affected the first initial board decision, the 2010 decision of the board to grant the CDUP without any stay. The 2012 CDUP that was granted post contested case hearing in Kila Kila still went on. The court did not touch that, and in fact, it went through the appellate process, and it is pending a decision before this very court. So even if the board was wrong, I believe that the remedy only affects the 2011 decision. It should not affect the process after the contested case hearing and the board's decision following that hearing.
Putting aside the violation types of contested case hearing based on a violation, I actually looked at the rules and I don't see a process that seems to say that you can have the violation issue and then have a contested case hearing. But in any event, putting aside those types of cases, which I think are a little bit different from this case, because in those situations, the BLNR has investigative and executive power and then switches to a quasi-judicial role. What I couldn't find any reported cases in which this process had been followed, where the board actually issued a permit and then had a contested case hearing. That's why I'm asking, when did the board start adopting this process? That's not what the board did in Morimoto, right?
I can't recall. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay.
But why, in this case, why have a vote before the contested case? Because, as Mr. Hanlon's pointed out, it appeared as though there clearly you had perfected requests for a contested case hearing, and it was clear that the parties also didn't want the decision made before a contested case hearing. Was it because then of the actual practice of doing it? Because it doesn't sound like it's that often where you have a request for a contested case hearing before the decision making on the public hearing.
I think there are two issues here. We do not agree that the requests were perfected. Second.
But you just heard the rule from Justice Pollack. An oral or written request for a contested case hearing must be made to the board no later than the close of the board meeting. These requests have been made for almost a year,
Oral requests made at the meeting from petitioners, and then we had one written request, and then then the petitioners were told to follow up with written petitions.
But Ms. Chena, does it matter if the permit that was issued already says that hadn't the board on its own accord decided to do it to conduct a contested case hearing anyway?
Absolutely.
So then if they were going to do a contested case hearing anyway, why issue? And I know you say that it was their intent that it be preliminary, but it doesn't say anywhere on the permit that it's preliminary.
You know, and this is just a matter of timing. When this case came to this court, in actuality, the Kila Kila case and this 30-meter telescope case, they were decided they came before the board within a matter of months. They're up before this court, separated by 2 years. But at the time, initially, the Kila Kila case did not stay or halt construction in any way, and so the court said because we were allowed to build, it's a final decision. A few months right after that, the court decided, the board decided, no, we don't want that. We don't want UH to construct or build while we're having a contested case, and we want to have a contested case on this. And so because of that, they did make a preliminary decision, but they included the requirement that nothing happened. And indeed, UH did not proceed during the pendency of the contested case hearing. They've been consulting with DLNR, with OCCL, and they did not proceed.
In terms of the BLNR, then, in terms of the dictates of due process and the importance of the appearance of justice and the appearance of fairness, does the BLNR believe that adopting these types of procedures satisfy those concerns? In other words, in terms of the issues, I hear one of the reasons being raised that is that, well, you know, if we issue the permit with the conditions, then people know what they're contesting. But if you look at, in a case like this, the staff officer's report has almost all of the recommendations as to what the conditions should be. Yeah. So the people, the contested case hearing could address the staff officer's report, not an actual permit. And in terms of a hearing officer who is appointed, and I assume paid by the BLNR to conduct these hearings, this court also has the power to adopt special masters or hearing officers. Should this court, do you think it would satisfy due process for this court to say, this is the judgment, this is the decision that we want, now go conduct a hearing?
That is not what happened. Two things. The first is that generally in the staff recommendation to the board and the staff submittal, the conditions that are included in the recommendations are straight out of the rules. The rules say you have to have all of these conditions, and there's like 20-something conditions. And that's what's usually included in the staff recommendation. The second thing is...
Well, there was a lot of other conditions that had nothing to do with the rules, this education and...
Well, that had come out...
The $1 million
and... Of the public outreach, and that was what the university had told OCCL and DLNR it's in order to include as part of the recommendation.
Do you think that the process that the BLNR followed here furthers public confidence in the system?
Yes, I do.
I ask folks, please don't respond if you can verbally so that the lawyer can focus on the questions and her answers. Thank you so much.
I really think they do. I mean, I think that just as a court goes into its decisions without having said, I prejudge this, and without any evidence that this matter was prejudged, I believe that the board,
there's no evidence of prejudge. They voted on it. They granted the permit.
Well, the court makes decisions too. And what if it's remanded back to the same circuit court? Have they made a decision? Have they prejudged? Is it always to be, the presumption of not being fair?
because you looked at it earlier, and in fact, when the board looked at it in the first place, they were not acting as a tribunal. They were acting as the landlord, and then when it came back to them, they were acting as the tribunal.
Ms. Gina, if I might switch to another topic for a moment.
Justice Wilson, can I just follow up on that point? Your position is the board acted in different capacities at the public decision-making hearing versus what it did after the contested case hearing. And if so, could you cite us to where in the rules that is reflected?
Well, in the rules, when the board has a board meeting, they have to act under Chapter 92, the Sunshine Law. And everything and all their decisions and everything they do is a matter of, they make all of the decisions, they talk, everything's on the record. I mean, you know, everything's out in the open. Once they decide to hold a contested case hearing and it is put into contested case land, then it is decided under Chapter 91. Chapter 91 has its own entirely separate set of rules and requirements, and their decision making in the contested case was complete, you know, was done pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 91.
You know, the problem with that argument, it's a very interesting argument and probably would have some persuasive weight, except for the fact that they issued the permit. And not only that, if there hadn't been a contested case hearing or nobody had satisfied the standing, you would have this document and you would have this permit that you argue would have been done under Chapter the Sunshine Law and not under Chapter 91. I mean, the document can't change based upon the fact whether there's a challenge. This is a permit. It was issued.
Yes, but it was a preliminary permit, and I think UH understood that it was a preliminary permit. The state, the BLNR, understood that it was a preliminary permit. Nobody acted on that. And in fact, the parties, the other petitioners, acted as if it was a preliminary permit. At no time did they seek injunctive relief to stop the construction of the telescope or from proceeding any further. Everybody, all parties, saw it as a preliminary matter.
So, Ms. Gina, if I could ask you about the conclusion that the TMT does not cause a substantial adverse effect on cultural resources, and get back to the question I had asked earlier about the way in which this was determined. Again, in the final EIS, the explanation is that from a cumulative perspective, the impact of past, present, and the project, together with other reasonably foreseeable future actions on cultural resources, is substantial, significant, and adverse. From a cumulative perspective, it says it's significant, substantial, and adverse. But then it goes on to say that in general, the project will add a limited increment to the level of cumulative impact, but would not tip the balance of any specific cumulative impact from a less than significant level to a significant level. And that's endorsed in the decision of the Land Board as well. So could you help me? How did this balance take place? What was it that led to the conclusion that the balance wasn't enough to mean that the telescope had a significant adverse effect on the cultural resources?
Okay. The language that you cited is from the FEIS. The FEIS is not mandatory.
I just started off with that so that I could show you where it came from, but it was actually in the board's decision. They go along with the incremental degradation analysis.
I believe it was because to start off with, the eight criteria by which the land board considers.
Well, I'm focusing on criteria four.
Yeah,
right.
But all of the criteria, it's a discretionary board permit.
It's not mandatory. And so what the board did is it looked at what was presented in the evidence, and significantly, it seemed they recognized after looking at the FEIS as well as all of the other documents that are listed that they reviewed, they found that significantly having 13 telescopes would not be substantially different from having 12 on the mountain. And I think the board's finding that this impact made it less than substantial is not clearly erroneous. They actually looked at having another telescope on that mountain, and they considered the weight of that.
Well, any further questions from the court? All right, Ms. Jean, anything else to wrap up, or is that it?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Give me the additional time.
Thank you very much. Now we'll hear from Mr. Werdemann in rebuttal.
Just very briefly.
Mr. Werdemann, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
Ms. Gina has represented that 95% of cases, a request for a contested case hearing isn't made until after a decision. In those cases, and when a contested case hearing is then held, how does that impact your due process argument?
Well, practice doesn't dictate our constitutional protections. Due process trumps any administrative rule, certainly. I don't know all of the circumstances under which such determinations are made in these other cases, but in
suppose there is a case where a request for a contested case hearing was not made until after the decision. How does that impact?
Well, that's not the case here, though, Your Honor. It was not only was there a request, but we had during the public hearing process, we had at least three petitioners saying, stop, you can't do this.
Well, how does Mr. Hanlon's argument about the necessity to perfect the request impact your due process argument?
They made all of the oral written requests that they could possibly make consistent with the rules. They even objected to the decision even being made by the BLNR to issue the permit. I don't know of anything further that the petitioners could have done in this case.
There was a party who made the oral request and also, or two written requests, or a written request and an oral request?
There was a variety of, some of the petitioners were actually present and some weren't.
I think, and Justice Pollack has quoted 13.129, an oral or written request for a contested case hearing must be made to the board, and then an agency or person so requesting a contested case must also file a written request. So a party did follow those two steps before the decision making.
Yes, there were parties that met all of those requirements.
Had they actually paid the $100? I understand there's a $100 fee for every person that wishes to perfect a request for a contested case hearing. That's a substantial sum. And I'm just wondering, are you saying that along with the original written petition that $100 fee was paid?
I'm assuming so, but I can't say 100%. I'm assuming they met all the requirements. It was never made an issue in any of the findings that all of the requirements to make the appropriate requests are made. If I may, just briefly with Justice Wilson's questions regarding the incremental impact. Chapter 183C1 and the findings of and purpose for Conservation District. The legislature finds that lands within the state land use conservation district contain important natural resources essential to the preservation of the state's fragile natural ecosystems, sustainability of the state's water supply, It is therefore the intent of the legislature to conserve, protect, preserve the important natural resources of the state throughout appropriate management and use to promote their long-term sustainability and the public health, safety, and welfare. It doesn't say in any of these provisions that once we passed substantial and adverse impact, it's okay at that point. I mean, it's obviously the whole intent of the conservation district are these things that I just read. And in fact, what's happening in this proposed project is they're actually extending the footprint now of all of the telescopes that are there to an area on the North Plain, just below the summit, which is extending it now further and further up on the mountain and away from the summit. So it's certainly there were substantial testimony about view planes. There is also the sighting of the largest number of archaeological sites being near that area, and so this whole idea of incremental.
Well, let me ask you about the incremental degradation, if I could. How do you address the idea that the mountain has become so degraded that its cultural significance has been impacted so significantly that there isn't enough culture left that there would be a significant impact from the telescope?
There's certainly, and the petitioners are those who are trying to practice their cultural practices. These are the types of things that need to be corrected to be in line with 183C1. You got this mess on Mauna Kea, as I stated earlier, it was a subject of state audits about the mess up there, the governor's comments that we need to be better stewards of Mauna Kea, and those types of remedial efforts need to be made, and with that, then we would submit when it is less than substantial and adverse, if it ever becomes such, with decommissioning and removal of the telescopes, then it may become an issue for consideration. But at this point, it's not, and we shouldn't continue to degrade. Otherwise, we'll have 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 20, 25 telescopes up there with the same argument.
Anything further, Mr. Werdeman?
No.
All right. I'd like to thank our attorneys, Mr. Werdeman, Mr. Hanlon, and Mrs. China for their presentations here today. I'd also like to thank our audience for your attentiveness and respect for the process during this very long hearing this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Keep trying.